Good morning, good afternoon. It is Heather Stark with Okay, now we go in. I'm Heather Stark with Blog Talk Radio. A little confusing today. One of our party is out for the day, so that leaves Deborah Adams and myself, Heather Stark, to hold up the fort here on the Blog Talk Radio show, Three Women. Three ways. Yes. And joining me right now is Deborah. If you would like to join us, the phone number is 646-378-0430, and you can also join us on our chat line, and we'd love to hear from you. We have a very interesting topic today, but first I'm going to ask Deborah to introduce herself, and I'll introduce myself a little bit.
Hey, glad to be here. I hope everyone's having a happy day. And just our friend Pinkley Connie Sue, we're sending her hugs and get well wishes. Not feeling well today. The chat room is open, Heather, so if you will keep your eye on that.
I will.
And, yes, who am I? Who am I today? I want to know who I am today. I am Deborah, and we come together as a group of three women who have had, you know, some similar experiences in life. I would like to just say that my tagline for my personal life is I've lived it, I've studied it, and I've worked it. And I'm talking about domestic violence and sexual assault and emotional abuse and all those things that go along with it. But it has given me a very unique point of view, I believe. And Heather, what about you? Tell us a little bit about you.
Well, similar to you, Deborah, I have lived it. I don't necessarily like talking about it a whole lot because it brings back bad memories for me. Uh-huh. But I have discovered a great interest in the studies and the research involving domestic violence. So like you, Deborah, I went back to school. I got a master's in public administration with a focus on domestic violence. And I'm one class away from starting my dissertation in psychology so that I can continue that work. So.
Well, congratulations, Heather. I know you've put a lot of hard work into that, and I'm so very proud of you and, you know, pleased to be able to say I know you.
Thank you. And if I can give a plug here, I also am author of a book, Why Doesn't She Just Leave? And that is available on Amazon or from whydoesn'tshejustleave.com. So that's a book that covers a question that many people who don't understand domestic violence frequently ask. But today, we are talking about one of my absolute hot-button issues, and that is child custody issues. And we are often, I think, if I can start out here, Deborah, one of the things that really irritates me is that there is a huge online and media presence by groups that support fathers' rights. Not that I don't think fathers' rights should be supported, but the fact is that if you look at these sites and if you look at a lot of this support, it actually offers support to abusive fathers for trying to work the system to get custody of their kids. And because we know that domestic violence is about control, once a woman says she's leaving, one of the few ways that the guy can still control her is through the courts and through custody. If I want to get back at you and you're a mother, the best way to do it is by trying to take away your kids, right?
Absolutely. That's a very severe threat and a very real threat in these cases because what we have learned over time, Heather, you can agree or disagree, is that our court system is not set up to handle the situation of domestic violence. It just doesn't handle it very well, especially when we're talking about civil systems interacting with criminal systems. And by civil, I mean it's usually your superior court that handles any kind of dissolution or child support or child visitation. And in trying to work with domestic violence causes a lot of issues, right? Because in the United States, it appears that all parents have rights to their children, regardless if they're abusive or not.
Correct.
And when one party says that, survivor of violence says, my partner, my husband, my spouse is abusive to me and that harms my children, the superior civil system does not recognize that very well. Do you agree with that?
I absolutely agree. As a matter of fact, when I talk with groups about the courts, I think one of the assumptions that the public has is that the going to court equals justice and fairness.
Right.
And it does not. It does not. Going to court is about a set of laws, and
yes,
those laws can be just sometimes, and sometimes they can't. And regardless of what the law is, it's up to a person, i.e. the judge, to interpret those laws and apply them to your particular case. And one of the things that we see too often in courts is an environment where there are three basic assumptions. One is that a father has a right to his children, and I would say nobody has a right to their children, especially if they're hurting them. The other one is that every child needs both parents. Well, again, I would say that if both parents are healthy and helping that child, of course that's true. But if one parent or both parents are detrimental to that child, then I don't think they have a right to see that child and help parent that child. And then the third issue is that women lie. And I don't think you'll get too many people to just outright say that, yes, that's what we believe. But the behavior of most courts follows those three assumptions, that fathers have a right to their children, that children need both parents, and that women lie.
Right. Regardless of what has been happening behind closed doors within the context of family. And so because it is a legal system and it's considered public policy-led and decision-makers such as our politicians are involved in it, they don't like to recognize the things that happen behind the closed doors. And even the very fact that our judicial system requires a victim or survivor of violence, whether it's domestic violence or sexual violence or any form of it, but to prove that they were harmed, seems backwards to me.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the thing that I think really distresses me is that although the courts say that they are interested in the children, that the reason that the courts are involved is because of the children, the fact is that court decisions often are most harmful to the children.
Right, and it's because they're not really truly looking at the best interest of the child. I think very often our judges, and if it goes to a jury, that the general public and the judges are swayed by how persuasive an attorney can be. And that's a problem for me because I find our judicial and court systems to be very adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a fact of who has the most access to resources, whether it be money, which is what you need to hire an attorney, and status, whether you have enough status to get the best attorney with the most training and the most experience in a case that is similar to yours.
Absolutely.
So most survivors of crime don't seem to have a lot of access to that resource, which puts them at a great disadvantage.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think one of the things that we need to understand, you know, as a society, is that most divorces handle everything just between the two of them. Child custody, money, everything. And about 85% of divorces are handled that way. The courts are not involved other than to officiate the divorce.
Right.
In that 15% of cases, though, there are issues that bring the parties to court. And of that 15%, about 85% have domestic violence somewhere in that.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're looking at, basically, and to generalize, is that we're looking at abusers who are the ones fighting for sole custody, for
mm-hmm.
the most part. And they will use whatever they can to try and bully that woman and to get their way, because that's what they do.
Absolutely. I know of someone that I worked with as a coworker, and their family was going through this divorce, and the abusive partner said to the mother that I am going to tie you up in court.
Yep.
I don't want this divorce. I don't want you to have these children or our belongings. I want them. So I'm going to use all my resources, which included her resources, in the state of Washington, where we're a community law society here, where married couples share, you know, all
community property.
He said, those are my assets, and I'm going to use those to tie you up in court. And did indeed do that for 3 years and literally fought over every stick of furniture
in court.
And, you know, that wears people out. It just, it drags you down. It keeps you in a depressed state, maybe, or a unhappy state, not at the very least, and always worrying what's going to happen next.
And worrying about your precious resources being used up and given to lawyers and courts.
Exactly. When wouldn't it have been a better scenario for that couple to say, we can't live together anymore. Let's divide these assets equally so we can each establish our own home that will be safe for our children regardless of who they're staying with.
But, Deborah, isn't that making the assumption?
Could have been handled differently.
I'm sorry. This is a hot button topic for me. I just charge in there, and I'm sorry. But when you say that, you're making the assumption that both parties are putting somebody, i.e., the children, ahead of themselves.
Yeah.
And with a controller, with an abuser, there is no one ahead of that abuser. His wants and his needs are greater than any other needs, including those of his children.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it comes down a lot of times to just that extreme example of control, right?
Mm-hmm.
And control can look a million different ways. And one of the most extreme things is I remember in 1999 when we were working with a group of survivors, we called ourselves Survivors in Service, and one of our members worked in a Seattle shelter domestic community program. And they had one of the people staying in their shelter who was murdered. And I remember how devastated she, as an advocate, was that that happened. And when she shared that with us, how devastated we were as a group, because this was a case of where this young woman who had a two-year-old daughter had absolutely followed the advice of everybody who told her what to do is you need to leave. She left. She went to shelter. You need to get a protection order. She got a protection order. You need to ask for sole custody. She did that and got it. You need to ask for supervised visitation. She did that and she got it. And the how it ended up in this horrific ending was that when she had the supervised visitation, the father abuser was supposed to leave the safe environment where the visitation occurred at the end of it. He was supposed to leave and go away. And then the mother was to come and pick up the child. And she was there. She came, picked up the child. They went to their car. She strapped the baby in the car seat. And the abuser pulled up behind her and shot both mother and child. And
again,
it's just so devastating because here, as I said, this was a person who had tried her very best, followed everybody's advice, done everything society asked her to do, yet she and her child lost their life over
it. And I'll bet you that...
It's giving me goosebumps right now to think and talk about it.
Yeah. The newspaper accounts, too, probably said what a great guy he was and how the neighbors couldn't believe it.
Oh, yeah. And we see that all the time, right, as advocates.
I know.
Anytime there's a murder in a couple situation, the neighbors are like, clueless. And we're asking you as the general public to stop being clueless and to watch for signs and to acknowledge those signs and, you know, reach out to people in those situations in the best and safest way you can, whether it's to call the police or when you see the couple involved, you know, is there something I can do? Can I support you some way?
Yeah.
You know, do you need resources? Whatever it could be. But we have to do something as a general public and not bury our heads in the sand. Now, that's my hot button.
Well, getting back to the whole issue of child custody, one of the things that if there is a fight, a disagreement over child custody and sharing custody, most people are going to be exposed to a guardian ad litem.
Mm-hmm.
A guardian ad litem may or may not be an attorney, but he or she is definitely somebody who's appointed by the courts and you have to pay, the parties have to pay them, but they're appointed by the courts to look out for the interest of the child. Now, I don't know about you, Deborah, you were never involved in this, but when I found out we were going to have a guardian ad litem, I thought, thank you, thank you. There will be somebody else who can see this, you know, who will advocate for my children. Well, it turns out that guardians ad litem, for the most part, do not spend a great deal of time. And they also are working with their own prejudices and their own histories in making these decisions. And it is not unusual at all for a guardian ad litem to meet once with the children, meet once with each parent, and maybe make a couple of phone calls to friends or family members and issue a decision to the court. And for the most part, the court follows those decisions.
Right. And the whole purpose of the guardian ad litem is to represent the child. Not to represent the parents, but to represent the best interest to the best of their ability in our current society to represent those children. And, it's really unnerving to me the fact that they very often don't have any contact with the child themselves.
Exactly.
You know, they just, I personally did not experience this, but I have another family member who did. And in our county, got assigned a guardian ad litem that we didn't have to pay for, thank God. We didn't have to cough up the money for that. But didn't meet with the family member until 15 minutes before the court appointment.
Yep. And think
this
of the life-changing
court record, and just was ready to make their decision for the best of that child. You know, how we managed to get out of that was the abusive father of the child never showed up, didn't contest. So
great.
Yeah, so we managed to live through that kind of unscathed. But if abusers will show up and we'll contest everything.
Yeah, exactly. As you may know, Deborah, I actually went through the King County training for guardians ad litem. And it was a real revelation for me to go through this training. And although there was lip service paid to acknowledging domestic violence issues, for the most part, they didn't really emphasize that there should be any consideration of domestic violence when making those decisions for placement of the child. And I think that goes right back to what we were saying at the beginning, that courts do assume that even if the person was abusive, even if one parent was abusive, doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to hurt the kids. Just because he beats the mother or abuses the mother doesn't mean he's going to do that to the kids.
Right.
Well, we can argue that. That's a whole other show, isn't it, Deborah?
Yes, there's studies that show and support that when a child witnesses any violence between people they love and admire, such as their parents, it's the same thing as if it happened to them.
Yes, absolutely.
Without even touching them, if the child witnesses it or hears it, doesn't even have to actually see it, but hears it, it's the same as if it had been done to that child. So that's pretty drastic and a real eye-opener for a lot of us folks.
Yeah.
That was one of the things I learned from my children as they grew up, because I insisted we talk about stuff, whether they wanted to or not. So we've often had conversations about what they observed as a child, and they continue to tell me, yeah, I saw that, Mom, and I knew that, and I was aware of that, and I was, you know, pretty humiliated by that fact, because for so many years I talked myself into the situation that, well, it's just happening to me, it's not happening to my children.
Yes, I can protect them.
Yeah, I'm protecting them because they're not in the room, because what would happen is they would scurry like scared squirrels to their bedroom and dive under their beds, you know, to cover their ears and try not to hear what was going on. So I assumed they were safe, but the truth of the matter is it was the same as if it happened to them. So,
well,
you know,
that
that's,
is one of the issues that women face when they make the decision to go to court, because suddenly, well, for that matter, make the decision to leave. Because once they're out of the environment, once they've left the father of their children, they can't protect that child, even if they are only marginally doing so, you know, within the marriage or within the relationship. Once they've said, I'm done, then that child is going to be required by the courts, in most cases, to spend time and be alone with that abuser.
Yeah.
And so many women will opt to just stay in an abusive relationship rather than risk that they won't be able to take care or help the child in that situation.
You know, and here's how I feel about that aspect, Heather. My kids were 12, how old were they? They were 15, 13, 12, and 10 when we separated from their father. Their father, in my opinion, actually used visitation as a way to manipulate and control me. He was supposed to pick the children up at a specific evening, at a specific time. We're all sitting there waiting. Children are packed to go spend the weekend with the father, and he would not show.
Mm-hmm.
About 3 or 4 hours later, we'd call and say, oh, this came up. I'll come and get him tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
And is that fair to the children?
Control,
you know, they sit here on the edge of their seat for 3 hours waiting for you to show up, and... oh, something came up, wasn't that, you know, and that happened time and time and time again. Finally, I said to the father, I said, here's the deal, the kids will be ready at the appointed day and time. If you don't show up, all bets are off. I'm going to allow them to, you know, to make their plans for their weekend as if they were here with me. That's it. You have that time to come and assert your right to have that, and if you don't come at that time, then you've given that up.
Deborah, if you had gone through the courts, you would not have been able to make that decision.
Right, but see, he didn't go through the courts.
You.
He didn't even attempt to enforce that. That's why I felt it was more of an attempt to manipulate me.
Of course,
didn't want me to have any free time.
Yep. He wanted you to be on pins and needles the whole time.
Sitting around waiting for him to show up.
But if the courts had been involved.
Had enough of that.
If the courts had been involved and he reported to the courts that you weren't cooperating with letting him be with the children, even if it's not their appointed time, then the courts can say, ooh, this other parent is doing custodial interference. And that's a horrible thing. If you're accused of custodial interference, you're almost guaranteed that the other person is going to get the kids. The other thing that they wave is parental alienation.
Yes.
And let me just start by saying that is a totally bogus. A terrible, terrible person, psychologist. Started that theory in the 90s, and he made quite a great fortune because he traveled the country testifying in courts about how the other parent alienated the children from the abuser.
Yeah.
Alienated the children by saying bad things and by brainwashing them, basically. Well, the problem with that is that then it became the assumption that if children didn't want to see that abuser, it was only because the mother, in most cases, had brainwashed them and done parental alienation. Apparently, it never occurred to anybody that kids might not want to go to somebody who's mean to them.
Or go stay somewhere where there's another partner that they don't know or like, you know, or there's other children from another relationship or whatever activities are going on there, you know. Yeah, fortunately for me, in my case, my kids were big enough to voice their opinion. And actually what happened in our case is I called the bluff. I said, go ahead.
Yeah. But if you're going to court, you can't afford to do that. You can't afford to risk
go
that.
Go ahead.
Because
one time I said, take all the children and have custody of them all the time.
Four. I imagine that's a daunting. You
I
didn't
can't
want
do that,
that at all.
Have enough room for them, and blah blah blah. And I'm like, oh, okay, whatever.
Yeah. But again, if you're going through the court system, you can't do that. You don't have power to do that. And if you do something like that, he will glom onto that, and you'll be back in court so fast your head spins.
Yes.
And once for some reason. The courts, again, based on this kind of unwritten assumption that women lie, once a woman is accused of parental alienation, if that judge or that guardian ad litem is so misinformed about that topic that they actually believe it,
mm-hmm.
yeah, then you're pretty much guaranteed that you, as a woman, are not going to get your kids.
Yeah, and we're not even talking about child support money, which throws another monkey wrench into the situation. Many times an abusive parent will use that as a way to manipulate. Well, if I'm paying support, I'm entitled to this, that, or the other. And it's like, whoa, I don't know about that. And then if they're paying support, they think they're entitled to know exactly what you spend the money on.
Yeah.
Whoa, none of your business, you know.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
and
in most cases,
all those things can often end up back in court yet again
mm-hmm.
to try to iron out all the kinks. And frankly, not only is it expensive to have an attorney, but, you know, there's the cost of having to leave your work if you're a working person during the time court is held, which is, you know, like 80% of the country.
Yep.
You know, the standard Monday through Friday, 8 to 5, is work hours
mm-hmm.
for so many people. And so if you get called to court at 1 p.m., you know, and you can get called to court and it can get canceled because something takes emergency or something takes precedence over it or takes longer than they had planned, so you could have to come back the next day.
Yep.
You know, and employers do not like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm looking at the clock here, Deborah, and I'm thinking, okay, we've painted a pretty bleak picture. what can a woman do if she's faced with child custody issues with her
abuser?
Well,
my advice, number one, is get yourself educated. You can self-educate yourself and do some research and talk to others, you know, maybe try to find someone who's had a similar experience and get their recommendations for a representation if they can afford it.
Yeah. Well, and I always say, you know, what would be terrific for most women going through this unusual type of divorce is find a divorce doula. You know how women who have babies sometimes have a doula that helps them, you know, become familiar with what this whole new procedure, this whole new process of having a baby? Chances are you've not gone through this experience before. So find somebody who has, and you can do that by going to groups, by going getting support from your local domestic abuse support group. And you find somebody who's been through this because they aren't going through the racing emotions that you are, and they're going to be able to look more objectively. Does this attorney have experience in this field? Does he understand this, or does she understand this? And they're going to be able to give you a little bit of advice about what to look for, how to behave. You know, you might think your first impulse would be, I'm going to run to court, and I'm going to tell him that he did this, this, and this. That could be, in fact, the worst thing you can do.
Yeah.
So what I would advise is that you, as you said, Deborah, educate yourself about custodial interference, about parental alienation, about the courts. You might even want to go, if you're able to sit in on a few cases in court. You're able to do that. What goes on in the court is public, so you can just go in and sit down quietly and watch.
Yeah.
But you have...
I guess I would also say to take everything... that you hear also with a grain of salt and rely on your own intuition about what's best for yourself. Because, you know, sometimes you think an attorney is an authority or has this role in our society that they know everything. They may or may not be trained on it.
Exactly.
Have experience representing people in this kind of scenario. So really it's up to you, and you've got to take charge and not keep your head in the sand, which is easy to do when you're already overwhelmed with money issues, work issues.
And you have to remember that an attorney may be a wonderful person, but that attorney is working for themselves. And once your case interferes with them or they don't like it anymore, they can drop it and
say
you must find a new attorney.
Well,
so the whole issue is really, really complicated, and especially with the child custody issues, and it's so important how a woman behaves, and when she's already overwhelmed, find somebody through group that can not only help you with the experience, but also help you with the idea of how you're to behave in court. what impressions you will give, because it makes a big difference. It makes a huge difference in dealing with an abuser and in dealing with the courts.
It does. And as we wrap up our show today, I usually end with a quote. And my quote is kind of a personal one that I like. It's, be the change you want in the world, which is, goes to support getting educated and advocating for yourself. So thanks for listening. We are three women.
Three ways.
And three divas.
Three divas.
Thanks for tuning in.
Deborah, are you still there?